Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, a lot you probably didn't know about the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders that might change the way you think about them. A new documentary by director Dana Adams Shapiro traces the history of the squad, which captivated sports fans nationwide in 1972 with a carefully calibrated mixture of girl-next-door sweetness and sex appeal. We'll talk with Shapiro and veteran cheerleaders Tony Washington and Shannon Baker Worthman about how founding director Suzanne Mitchell helped invent the squad and then protected its image and its members like a mother lion. We'll also hear how cheerleaders have faced down criticism from feminist groups. Our conversation starts after a short break. Sports fans of a certain age may remember 1972 as the year the Dallas Cowboys became America's team. They won their first Super Bowl that year, and the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders took the field, and these were no ordinary cheerleaders. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. General Manager Tex Schramm had the idea for a professional all-female squad of sideline performers. But his best idea may have been assigning Suzanne Mitchell, at that time the only woman on the Cowboys' executive management team, to make his vision a reality. Mitchell combined her expectations of impeccable behavior on and off the field with a liberal dose of sex appeal that delighted many football fans and infuriated some feminists. Dana Adams Shapiro is director of the new documentary Daughters of the Sexual Revolution, the untold story of the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders. Former cheerleaders Shannon Baker Worthman and Tony Washington are featured in the film, and they're here as well. Welcome all of you to Think.
Thank you very much.
So it's a little hard to imagine this. The earliest cheerleaders for the Dallas Cowboys were high school kids, boys and girls.
Yeah, in 1960, when the team started, there was a woman named Dee Brock. She was the original director, and they were called the Cowbells and Bo. And they were high school kids, co-ed, and they did cheers. They weren't doing what we now think of as professional cheerleading, which is more, they were more like dancers. They were cheer squads.
So I'm sure they were great, but they weren't drawing people to the Cotton Bowl.
And actually, in 1960, Mr. Schramm hired some professional models from Dallas. And they were very pretty, but it didn't make the connection with the fans. And also, they didn't have the stamina to get through the games, because it can get brutally hot and brutally cold at Texas Stadium when the roof was open.
You need to be fit and ready to go in order to stay on that field the whole time.
Absolutely.
So Tex Schramm was ahead of his time in recognizing that football would ultimately be a television event. I mean, of course, there's all the fans in the stadium. What did Bubbles Cash have to do with his vision for the cheerleaders?
Bubbles Cash in 1967 walked down the steps on the 50-yard line carrying two fistfuls of cotton candy. And as she did this, everybody in the stands turned around. The television cameras caught it. She was in the newspapers the next day. Bubbles Cash upsets the Cotton Bowl. And then she became something of an unofficial mascot for the Cowboys because Tex Schramm saw how popular she was. She was this very lovable, sweet, very pretty woman. And this was when he got the idea, wow, look at the response that people have. You know, what is America like more than cowboys? Cowgirls. And it was because of this walk that he had, that was sort of the light bulb moment. And then he hired a woman named Texie Waterman who came in, who was the choreographer. She's the one who really brought jazz to the football field. But it all started in 1967.
So Schramm would ultimately tap Suzanne Mitchell to supervise the ongoing transformation. She was an administrator for the team doing financial stuff, which is so amazing that he was able to recognize that she could really be in charge of all this. She was working on contracts. The idea initially was that this would be like a spare time job for her in addition to all the other things she had to do.
Yes, he asked her to handle those girls. You know, it wasn't like it was laid out. It was just, in your spare time, can you, you know, oversee and kind of coordinate those ladies? And that's how it started.
It was not a spare time job for her.
It wasn't spare time, but if you knew Suzanne, you knew she could be in charge of anything.
Anything.
She really had a vision, and it wasn't just a vision for how everybody would look and perform. It was a vision for the way that the team would be perceived by fans.
Yeah, it was a cross-section of the American woman, which I find very interesting because the fans are all different, so why not have the ladies all different? And that's what she brought to it. And in supporting the identity of the corporation, she wanted to also support the individual ladies that she chose. And that has to be, very difficult when the territory was unknown at the time. She could have gotten all 5'7" blondes,
right.
But she didn't. She had a lot of courage there, and she knew the fans were different. They were going to be able to relate to different kind of women, to different looks. So she brought that to the fans, and it worked perfectly.
And
short, tall, redheaded, blonde, all different occupations. So,
if you Suzanne was about the woman, she was about the female. So she wanted little kids or women or anybody to aspire, always aspire to be better, to do more, to give more. So with that, she wants a little girl in the stand or a young girl in the stand or anybody in the stand to say, that person looks like me. I could do this. You know, she believed in positive energy.
What's remarkable about this is this was all happening at a time when, like, Dallas schools, for instance, were not fully integrated. The city was really struggling with this sort of thing.
Dallas has had a challenge. I mean, Texas has had a challenge with that. And for me, when I came on, it was immediate sisterhood. There was no energy room for anything. The uniform made you. You didn't make the uniform. You became an overnight celebrity. And here are the rules, and here's how we're going to make this work. And it worked.
Dana, how were you drawn to this story?
I was watching the Super Bowl in 2015. I'm from Boston. The Patriots were playing. And the camera panned over to the cheerleaders, and I don't watch a tremendous amount of football, and I remember thinking to myself, we take this for granted. We see cheerleaders everywhere in every sport now, but where did this all come from? And I did some research, and sure enough, it started in Dallas. And, you know, you have a concept, but you don't have a character yet. And so we started, you know, interviewing a lot of the girls, and everybody was just talking about Suzanne. So finally, when we found her, it was that was sort of the – this was not a short film. This was going to be a feature-length documentary because she had that star power. You know, she had that story to tell that was so multi-layered. You know, one of the things that was fascinating to me was, you mentioned earlier that this was a time when schools were segregated, and the arc of a city going from, you know, in 1963, this is the city of hate, and then, you know, not too long after, they're home to America's team. And part of that was because of the Cowboys. You know, they brought people together at a time when everything was really fractured. You know, and someone, Byron, says this in our film, you know, black people went to black schools, white people went to white schools, black people went to black churches, white people went to white churches. Everybody went to Texas Stadium on Sunday. And that it would be this unifying factor, that's something that everybody in Dallas could sort of rally behind. The Cowboys and the cheerleaders, I think, were hugely important and very, just a real balm, you know, for the city in that time.
I think it is maybe sometimes hard for younger listeners to even conceive of what Dallas felt like in those early years after the assassination of President Kennedy. Mm-hmm. But people would, there are so many stories of people traveling all over the world and telling somebody they were from Dallas and then having people sort of like, you know, get up and move to another table in a restaurant or something. That it wasn't a small thing. Mm-mm. That Dallas wasn't proud of itself for a long time.
Yeah, and some people still believe that. I mean, think that. When you say Dallas, they think of the assassination. They think of the Dallas television show with JR. And they think of the Dallas Cowboys and the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders. Well, I like to think that the Cowboy cheerleaders put a smile on your face where the others might, you know, be a little more controversial and sad, and that the cheerleaders and the Cowboys, they really did. They caused everyone to rally. And I'm not comparing the television show to the assassination, but when people think of Dallas, they still think of those three things.
All right. What were tryouts like?
There were so many exotic and beautiful women that tried out. I mean, it was tons and tons and tons. And I had no idea what to expect, but you show up and you freestyle dance and they're looking at your movements and your smile and how you carry yourself and hold yourself, blah, blah, blah. And then you get another letter that invites you to semifinals. And then in semifinals, you learn a routine and you do it back, and you're, you know, with other individuals trying out. And then finals is the coup de grace. That's when the big guns come. The veterans come back. They have to audition every year if you're a veteran, if you want to be on the squad, and they try out with you. Talk about intimidation. You just know, oh, they're, well, you're counting spaces because they take 45 girls to training camp, and there's four groups of eight on the field. So you're counting, oh, you know, she's going to make it, all right. But it's not necessarily that. There were veterans that did not make the team back. And Shannon was a choreographer, so she can tell you even more the thought process to that.
The ladies on the squad are really dancers slash athletes. A lot of them have been technically trained for years and years, and the dance society can kind of be pretentious and a little snotty at times. And for me, I had two passions growing up. One was dancing, and I would study ballet for 6 days a week. And then on Sunday, my second passion was football. So after church, our family rallied around. So when I hear they're just cheerleaders, that really sets off, you know, my buttons, because I was a dancer, and I thought, how in the world can I? Well, let me back up a second here. When I was graduating from high school, I knew at that time I was not tall enough or thin enough to be a professional ballerina. So I thought, am I going to throw all this talent, all this skill away?
All that work.
All this, you're not kidding. All this work away? Heck no. And I thought, what can I do with it? And then I thought, I heard from KVIL, Ron Chapman.
Radio station.
A very popular DJ at the time. He advertised in 1976 that there would be a public tryout. Before, they had been handpicked from Texie Waterman's dance studio. So now there was going to be a tryout open to the public for women. And I thought, my gosh, I can't believe this opportunity. I can combine my dance skills on a 100-yard stage with so many people in the audience. So I could really transfer that over. And then I had a front row seat, didn't have to buy a ticket, front row seat to watch my team. So it was a win-win situation for me. And as it developed, the ladies got more talented, more skilled. It is a great gig for dancers. And I can't be more proud to tell of their all their accomplishments and achievements, you know.
Tony, you mentioned earlier you become a Dallas Cowboy cheerleader. You are an overnight celebrity. Were you prepared for that?
No, I wasn't. I want to tell you I wasn't. In the film, there's going to be an edit at the end of the movie because it says I couldn't dance. That was Dana Presley. Let's just get that out there. But I wasn't prepared because I had no idea about all the rehearsing and I literally used to write steps down. It's like it was just unbelievable.
Overwhelming.
It was overwhelming. Mm-hmm. And then you can't go out looking any kind of way. You have to get up in the morning and dress like you're a movie star, you know.
Even to go to the grocery store.
To go to the grocery store. Mm-hmm. There's no flip-flops, although I wouldn't have worn that anyway. But there's no, you know, you have a presence. You have an expectation to present yourself in a certain way, and it's always about the uniform because people are going to look at you and relate, oh, I know you from somewhere. Are you a cheerleader? You know.
And then standards are high.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then you're not matched up to what the expectation is. So that's why you became an overnight celebrity. So everything changed.
Tony probably knew a lot about the cheerleaders going in, but it's like when they say, I want to be a mother so badly. And you go, well, you know how hard that's going to be?
Oh, I don't, no, it's fine.
I don't care. That's what I want. You know, it might be a little apples and oranges, but once you get into it and you actually experience it, it's hard. It's a lot of hard work, but worth it.
We'll talk about more about that in just a minute with my guests. You just heard the voice of Shannon Baker Werthmann, formerly with the Dallas Cowboys cheerleading squad. Tony Washington is with us as well. And Dana Adam Shapiro, director of a new documentary called Daughters of the Sexual Revolution, the untold story of the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or find us on Twitter. We're at KERA Think.
They were what I was here for. I never thought about marriage. I had a lot of children. And I felt so deeply about them that they became totally and completely why God had put me here. And I believed in it so strongly that it was easy for me to give every ounce of energy I had to it.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. That was the voice of the late Suzanne Mitchell, who was director of the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders. We're talking this hour with three people involved with a new documentary about the squad. Dana Adam Shapiro is the director of Daughters of the Sexual Revolution, the untold story of the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders. Tony Washington and Shannon Baker Werthmann are featured in the film. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Dana, I know that that Suzanne had done a lot of media over the years. It was part of her job. But she doesn't seem like someone who was interested in a lot of personal attention. So I wonder if it was a challenge to get her to agree to participate in the film.
First of all, you're 100% correct. She was always taking a back seat, and it was the cheerleaders who were up front, and she was always the one, the wizard behind the curtain, so to speak. She was very sick when I called her with pancreatic cancer, and her vetting process of me, I think, was accelerated by that fact, because here she is at the end of her life, and I called her on the phone and said, I want to make this film about you, and she wanted to make sure that she was going to give this gift to the right person, I guess. And so we got along very quickly and very fast. I think we both realized, well, if we're going to do this, we need to move quickly. She said, if you're serious, you need to come down here because I'm dying. And so I sent her a copy of, I made another documentary called Murder Ball, and I sent that to her, and she really liked it, and it just opened the door. And I just always saw it as like this sort of fateful exchange, you know, that right at the end of a person's life. And in that clip that you played, you know, you hear a person who's speaking with such clarity and conviction about their purpose. You know, that was something that was sort of transcended cheerleading or football or anything like that for me. And making this movie, you have somebody that was about mortality. It was about legacy. It was about, you know, what are we here to do? And to hear someone who looked back on something that some people might find frivolous, you know, cheerleading, but that was her way to create family and sisterhood. And that was her way to serve her country through DOD USO tours, all through cheerleading, something that, again, even, you know, I originally thought that it was sort of a bit silly. You know, I didn't know anything about it. And that was what was so interesting for me, is that I didn't know much about this going in. This film was an exploration for me. You know, I didn't grow up here. I didn't grow up knowing any cheerleaders. It was really that investigation that became part of the filmmaking process for me, because I didn't know very much at all. And my expectations and stereotypes were shattered.
It's always exciting when you have a project that you think you know something about and then you realize you knew nothing.
It's the best thing to feel dumb.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
When you realize, I was wrong, and then your mind opens, right? Because you had this narrow-minded view, and then you realize, oh, I was being a little judgy.
One of the really interesting thing about that clip and about the presence of Suzanne within the film is that I knew that she was ill when you were filming, but you wouldn't know it if someone hadn't told you. Like, it's almost like a credit to her ability to just put aside whatever she's feeling in the moment and get the job done. She really comes across as someone who's just incredibly vital, even though I imagine she was in some pain and was physically diminished. You don't see that in the film. She is giving she's chosen to work with you, and she's giving everything she had to those interviews.
Yeah, when we got there for the final one, she said, look, I'm going to have to do, 10 or 15 minute bursts and then rest. And sure enough, we put the camera on, like 90 minutes later, you know, she took that first rest.
Sounds like she didn't want to rest before she took care of the women she called her girls as well.
And it's a trust thing. Dana's doesn't give himself as much credit as he should. This was not the first time Suzanne was approached about doing a documentary. And, you know, everything in God's timing, it just came together that Dana contacted her at the time, and they had a connection. Because had they not had a connection, it wouldn't have happened. She just had so much to give, and the story needed to be told about what she had accomplished in her life. And he captured it. He really did.
It was told with such dignity and respect for her legacy to be carried on. And Tony and I want to be ambassadors for Suzanne, who gave us this gift of this film, I believe, through Dana and Kara, the producers of the film. And we believe that it's her gift that she keeps on giving, that she keeps giving. And we want to do her justice. And when I was listening to Dana a minute ago talk about he would call the former cheerleaders at first and want to interview, and we didn't want to do it until we got Suzanne's so-called permission. And he must have thought, who are these ladies? How old are these ladies? But then when you heard that sound clip of Suzanne, you could see why we did want her approval and her permission. She had given so much to us and protected us for so long. We wanted to protect her and have her back. And especially when we knew she was so sick, we wanted to make sure she was okay with the direction that we were going. And I think Dana, once he met Suzanne, understood why he needed her approval for us to say, go for it.
The very first thing she said to me, I pulled up and she was sitting on her porch and she goes, "You're late."
That doesn't fly.
All right, here we go. I know what this is going to be like.
Let's talk a little bit about Suzanne's rules, because these were legendary, right?
Go ahead. Shannon knows them, I mean, probably backwards. Now, a lot of cheerleaders, squads, have incorporated them.
Mm-hmm.
But
the rules were few at first. Suzanne and I both came in the same year, 1976, and neither of us knew what we were doing because this was brand new territory. So she wrote down a few rules, and I was looking back at them the other day, and one was, the uniform will be supplied to you. However, you must buy your own boots. I thought, buy your own boots? Really? Well, a lot has changed since then. And one of the rules was we would rehearse two nights a week before the season and one night a week during the season. Oh my goodness, I don't think we ever followed that rule. We were at the studio all the time. So, but the rules were funny at first, and her book was maybe a couple of pages, and then it expanded. It became very thick as times changed and as she began to really understand what she needed to do to help us, those rules got, you know, more complex.
So she was fiercely protective of the squad and of its image. So I'll confess, I had heard of this pornographic film, Debbie Does Dallas. I never knew what it was about. Somebody came along and made a film about a young woman who wanted to try out for the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders. I mean, what sort of impact did that have on the way you were perceived? And did you all have to fight back against that? Or was it just something that you could set aside and think, this is nonsense?
Well, first, it wasn't just anybody who made that movie. This was the New York mob who made the movie, Carmen Galante and Mickey Zaffirano, and they made this film without getting any permission from the Cowboys. And it was a very popular pornographic movie. And Suzanne was furious that the uniform, which she thought was, there's a line in the film which says, when you put this uniform on, it's like wearing the American flag. And somebody says, now maybe that was a bit much, but I believe that Suzanne believed that. And I believe that Suzanne believed that. It represented her country. And so to see it used in such a foul way, she got $1 million from the Cowboys. She went to New York. This guy pulled a knife on her in the elevator of the courthouse, put it to her throat. She had food tasters. She had bodyguards. Like, this woman was fearless in protecting what was hers. And I think that's like just a perfect example when you see somebody who lives with that type of courage and that type of integrity and that type of fearlessness, who would go after, like I said, like these were like Carmine Galante was like one of the baddest gangsters in New York, you know, and she wasn't scared. I mean, I shouldn't say that. She was scared, but it wasn't going to stop her.
Well, courage is being scared and doing it anyway. Right?
Exactly.
So and she, I was a cheerleader at the time, and we knew so little of this because she didn't want to bother us with it. Mm. She wanted our, I was 20 maybe at the time, and I was doing my 20 selfish thing and thinking about myself and being a good Dallas Cowboys cheerleader. And she didn't want that to be a point of contention that we had to discuss with people. So she took care of everything so we didn't have to. And the ladies on the squad that were named Debbie at the time, they did take some flack, and they, you know, they were asked ugly questions. And she said, I'd be damned. I'm going to, you know, nip this in the bud. And she did.
It's really interesting to me that it seems like a lot of you have stayed really close. I mean, you can get really close when you're in your 20s and maybe you're in school or in your first job. And a lot of people drift apart. It seems like there's still sort of an ongoing sorority of people who have served as Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders.
I can pick up the phone and dial any cheerleader, whether I know her or not, and tell her who I am, and there is an instant connection. The integrity has been instilled and been maintained. I can, because of the uniform and the rules and things like that. And you want to help. You want to, you know, it's, I guess like any, I wasn't a part of a sorority, but I guess once you're in the unit, you want to protect anybody in the unit. And you want to help and elevate and stand behind. It's instilled in you because you were treated that way.
And as a Stevie Nicks song, I'm paraphrasing, but something about the glitter fades, but the feeling's still there. Mm. And our glitter has faded somewhat, but the feeling is still there.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like maybe you carry something of that experience with you into your future career.
Right. I do staffing for the insurance industry, and I've worked for lots of staffing companies, and Suzanne was always, why don't you go out on your own and do it? You know, still, after I retired from being a cheerleader, I toured with her for 3 years, and we became even closer. As Shannon knows, when you get on the other side, you have your eyes open to a lot of things and why things happen. But she pushed me at this age to step out and do things on my own, and I did.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about the new documentary, Daughters of the Sexual Revolution, the untold story of the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders. If you'd like to join us, you can email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. So the cheerleaders are everywhere in the 70s. They're like on Love Boat and in TV movies and game shows and the USO tour and that sort of thing. I wonder, you know, that if that attention is what caused a backlash from people who thought there's something unbecoming of women in this age of second wave feminism. There's a really interesting kind of pushback in the film from women who were very proud of this job and doesn't think it takes anything away from their ability to be an empowered woman. But I want to know what that sounded like and felt like. In the moment when you were sort of hearing some women criticize you as women for doing this thing that you loved?
My words are measured here, but I felt I was an independent young woman doing what I wanted to do. I made my own choices. Nobody forced me into it. We worked so hard. Mm. Why would I do that? If I felt exploited in any way, I might have felt overworked and I felt burnt out at times, but never exploited. I had, though, to think and to try to understand where they were coming from, some of these women that were judging us without knowing us. And I get it. I see why they could look at us and look at the movements we were doing on the field. And even though I would never say they were vulgar, and I come from a big dance background, some people could use that word. It's an easy word. They don't understand grand battements and hip rolls and things like that. So, you know, it's easy for them to judge, oh, look what they're doing, look what they're wearing. And I felt very covered up as a cheerleader. I had worn costumes growing up, much more revealing, leotard and tights, much more revealing than that. But I can see how women that are quick to judge, again, could say, this is putting feminism, you know, back a couple of steps. And I didn't feel that way. I felt very empowered that I was doing what I wanted to do.
Dana, you've said that your thinking changed and you realized what you thought you understood was different. Did your ideas about the relationship of the cheerleaders to the feminist movement change over the course of making the film?
Yeah. I mean, I think that I probably fell into that category at first of seeing them on the sidelines dressed the way that they were dressed and cheering on the big, strong men, that maybe it wasn't a symbol of empowerment or progress for women. But that was before I spoke to any of them. And I think that it is all about why do you do this? And more importantly, what exactly do you do? Because when we think of cheerleading, we only see them on the sidelines of the games. We don't know about the tours that they do. We don't know about the visits to the veterans' hospitals and to the children's homes. And so cheerleading became, for me, well, it was so much more than cheering. And it really was a lifestyle, and it really was. Dana Presley, who's in the film, said, you know, I never thought that I would find my purpose through cheerleading, but it is what brought me the most fulfilling aspect of my life, which was, well, how do you serve? And this was how they found it. So I felt, you know, this very judging a book by its cover condemnation, when you look at them and you think, oh, this is one thing, and then you realize when you actually speak to them. I think it'd be the same thing with politics, people who demonize those who disagree with them, whether it's politically or otherwise, and you turn people into cartoons, you turn them into caricatures, and then when you can actually speak to them, I think you realize that we're all a little bit closer together than we thought. And it was like that for me with this, you know. But at the same time, you know, I could also understand why the feminists in their snap judgment would think that. It's unfortunate that they didn't go one step deeper and maybe interview some of them. They were judging the book by the cover.
All right. My guests this hour are director Dana Adams Shapiro of the film Daughters of the Sexual Revolution, The Untold Story of the Dallas Cowboys Cheerleaders. It's a documentary. Also with us are Tony Washington, former cheerleader, and Shannon Baker-Werthman, another former Dallas Cowboys cheerleader. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or go to Twitter. We are @KERAThink. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are former Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders Shannon Baker-Werthman and Tony Washington, and director Dana Adams Shapiro, whose new documentary is called Daughters of the Sexual Revolution, The Untold Story of the Dallas Cowboys Cheerleaders. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Just to be clear for people who aren't, because I didn't fully understand this, being a Dallas Cowboys cheerleader, at least during the season, is very much like a full-time job, but it is for no one a full-time job. At least in the years that you all were doing it, everybody had to either be married, a student, or working somewhere else. This was not your bread and butter.
It was $15 a game, $13.99 after tax.
Boy, that 101 probably hurt, didn't it?
You did get paid to do appearances and sign autographs, open in a mall or things like that. Or DOD USO tours, you did get income for that. But other than that, and it really, she didn't want it to be, she wanted you to do it from the heart. Mm-hmm. And so if you remove the money, you get the passion.
All right, I want to go to the phones now, 1-800-933-5372. Amanda is on the line in Austin. Hi, Amanda.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Okay, thanks for taking my call. I was curious, I understand the sexual revolution and empowerment to do, you know, what you want to do with your body. Is there an issue with the league treating the cheerleaders differently than the players as far as compensation and behavioral requirements and things like that that speaks more to the issues of feminism than, you know, the perception of promiscuity or whatever that might be?
Thanks for your call.
I've read articles, many articles, especially lately, as I'm sure your caller has too. And so I know what the articles say. I can't verify those, but I know what the women are saying that have been reported in those articles about, you know, undercompensated, which I'm sure that they are, because it's just too many hours. I'm sure it would be well under minimum wage if you broke it down. I've heard of exploitation, that they are asked to do appearances where alcohol is being served, or they might be asked to go out on a tailgate where they're uncomfortable, getting up and personal with, you know, too close with the fans without security there. I've heard of a lot of these stories. And I know during my time back in the Tech Shram, Suzanne Mitchell days, we were not asked to do any of that. Texas Stadium did not have alcohol served there. And really, when you put alcohol and pretty women in the cowboy cheerleader uniform, it's not a good mix. But I think across the NFL, and Tony would, she's been in this more recently, but I think there does need to be oversight.
Yes, I think we're at a place now where the NFL has to identify the cheerleaders for all organizations as a part of the NFL. So either they're going to be the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders or cheerleaders for the Dallas Cowboys and separate that entity and manage that process and put rules in place. You have responsibility and accountability when your name is associated with something. NFL cheerleaders, you can't just go, oh, that organization over there runs it this way. So to the caller, yes, it is. The cheerleading has become a big revenue-generating commodity for NFL. And now it's time for change. You've got to put policies in place.
Is there organizing happening?
What do you mean?
Are cheerleaders looking to gain pay equity, that sort of thing? I mean, they are. There's no question that you in your time and women who are doing this job today are making money for the organizations.
Correct.
To cheer for.
Yeah, back in the day when it was first starting in the 70s, we were an expense arm of the Dallas Cowboys organization. And it was an expense that Mr. Schramm, it was worth taking. And it paid off. And now I'm sure they are an independent profit center. So I think that the women, the workforce, which are the women, have some leverage. And I think they should be compensated. And I don't think they should be sent out on appearances where they feel uncomfortable.
At least I'm sorry, please go ahead.
And they probably shouldn't be fired for doing things that the men are allowed to do. You know, if you're making rules for people based on gender or color or any other, you know, superficial aspect of who you are, I mean, I don't think that's going to go on much longer.
At least in your film, Dana, things took a turn when Tech Shram was no longer part of the organization, when Suzanne Mitchell was no longer part of the organization. Talk a little bit about that.
It seemed, you know, with the changing of the guard, there was a changing of the culture. And there was a very famous walkout in 1989 when 14 women, after Suzanne left and after the rules were being loosened at the time or talked about, Jerry Jones was going to say, you can fraternize with the players, you can appear where there's alcohol. You know, again, I'm not here to say that that was right or wrong, but the people who walked out, and Suzanne certainly also, they felt it was wrong. It was not what they signed up for. It was not it wasn't something that they wanted to be associated with. And so I think Tony uses the word culture in the film. It was just a different culture. And I think ultimately a lot of the blowback at the time made Jerry Jones change his mind, and it went back to the way that it was.
All right, I want to go back to the phones in just a moment. If you want to be one of the people calling the show, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org. Looks like we have that next call still gearing up online. Can you all talk about, you know, this idea comes up in the film, and I think you mentioned it early, earlier, Tony, that you don't make the uniform makes you. When you have made the squad, this thing that you have worked so hard to do, what does it feel like the first time you try on a Dallas Cowboys cheerleader uniform?
Well, it didn't exactly happen like that. You go to training camp. So you really don't tell anyone you're a cheerleader until you clear training camp. So they take 45 girls, they did, and then 36 make the, is that right?
Eight times four, 36.
Okay, math genius here.
Times four is 36.
8 times 4 is 32.
32 plus four alternates.
Yeah, four alternates. See, we're getting there collectively. But anyway, so you clear training camp, and that's when you get fitted for your uniform, and the first time you put it on, it's like anything you've worked for. Like you go through the interviews. You know, like when you wanted this job, you interview, you prep your resume, you interview, you talk, and you finally get the job. And the first day on the job, it's like, oh my God, I got it. So it's that same sensation. It's just overwhelming. And they have ring ceremonies now, I believe, but we actually got our ring on the first day of the game. And mine's never come off. So it's just the whole overwhelming accomplishment. And you feel like you're a part of it because you've gone through it with other ladies that you're cheering with.
When you think about the uniform, how iconic it is, when I tried out in 76, I didn't even know what the uniform looked like. Four decades later, I bet you could put, even for, you know, not a football fan or an avid fan, but if you put that uniform in front of somebody, a picture of that, they will be able to say, let me place it. That's a Dallas Cowboys cheerleader's uniform. That is pretty spectacular. Something I'm very proud of.
And it was recently inducted into the Smithsonian, the outfit and the poster, right?
The poster and the pom-poms. And
yeah, it is a
uniform.
Part of American culture. You know, I think you're right, that idea that you would be able to see
Don't
that
you think?
Uniform.
Even someone that doesn't follow football.
I can't think of another cheerleader uniform where you would say that's...
Right.
You would have that type of recognition that it's that it is become... Like, there is an iconography associated with this organization that is, you know, absolutely part of pop culture.
And it was designed for the stadium. So that the midriff is because you're in a stadium that it gets up to 100 degrees, and plus it's hotter down there because there's no circulation. Tons of media, players, there's a lot of people on the field. The boots were so that you could see the leg movements, because if you're way up high, you can't see what their legs and feet are really doing. The long sleeves were because... If you just have arms with the pom-poms, just like pom-poms, when you get up high. So she was always selling up. So that's when you have the fabric on the arms, you
there.
Can see the movements. So it was all for entertainment.
I have seen the Cowboys play in places where it's very, very cold and snowing. What my daughter's in drill team, and I worry so much about her when she's out there in her little costume. How are there strategies for ignoring how freezing cold it can be when you have to cheer?
I have some frostbitten feet from cheering when it was really cold. As a dancer, I would much rather perform in the heat than in the cold. Mm. And I've had it where the pipes were bursting in our dressing room, and we were on that field, and those diehard fans were there and expecting us to be there. And
there is no winter uniform, right?
We had warm-ups that we wore.
Jackets.
Yeah, jackets. But in those, there was no protection with those boots. Our feet were so wet and so cold, and yeah.
This is sounding like the first not fond memory that I have stirred in y'all. All right. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Let's go back to the phones now. It looks like Brittany in New York City. Hi, Brittany.
Wow. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Hi, Mom. My mom is Shannon Baker Worthman.
Oh, hi.
You sound great.
Hi, Britt. Thank you.
Hi, I have a question for you. So I'm a dancer in New York City for the audience. And the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders, that name, even up here, is just as iconic as back in Dallas. And I've never noticed any other NFL cheerleading squad maintaining that fame. And I was just wondering what you attribute that legend to and why the name has stuck around with such a good feeling behind it.
Thanks for your call.
I attribute it to Suzanne Mitchell fighting the mafia to keep the uniform out of places where it shouldn't be, setting rules in place so people just don't run rampant. Can you imagine not having rules with the social media? Everybody's a celebrity. Facebook today? No. You have to have rules and hold people accountable, whether that means somebody gets uninvited from the squad or fired from the squad or whatever. It's how you set things in place, just like when you're raising your children. We were her children, and you have to establish guidelines. And when it's respected, it just goes forward. It's like people want to call us cowgirls. Well, no, we were the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders. Even to that nth degree, she would instill.
Because we were representing the corporate identity. That's why we were there, was because of the Dallas Cowboys organization. And my daughter is a Rockette, and I couldn't have been because I'm too short. So I was able to be a Dallas Cowboys 5'3", and I was able to be a Dallas Cowboys cheerleader because it's a cross section of the American woman, and and our standards, they really were. They were maintained. They were high. Our expectations were there, and there were consequences.
Suzanne sort of laughs in the film that she had spies around, or she wanted you all to think that she always knew what you were up to, whether she was present or not. She died in 2016, is that right?
Yes.
Now that she's gone, and now that you all have been off the squad for a number of years, I wonder if you still go through moments in your life and think, Suzanne would disapprove of this, or Suzanne would be so proud of me right now.
Absolutely. It was like a finishing school for me. So I don't know what direction my life would have taken, you know, had I not been a Dallas Cowboys cheerleader. I wanted to be a Dallas Cowboys cheerleader. It was something that I told myself. I went to Skyline before all the magnets broke off. It was Skyline Career Development Center. And I was a computer programmer, COBOL, Fortran. Mm-hmm. So I do know math. And it was just, you know, it was another level. It elevated my life, and I'm a better mother. I'm a strong leader. I am for women. I don't look at women and judge them the way we were judged. And, you know, as women, we're quick to judge. It's just, it's in us. So there was no room for it. There was just no room for it. She just wouldn't stand for it.
And I think about her all the time. In doing public relations for this beautiful movie, I'm trying to channel Suzanne and say, put words of wisdom in my mouth. Let me make you proud. Let me continue the legacy that the only reason that I'm doing this is because of you. So, of course, we want to continue to make her proud.
There was a moment in the editing room where we were trying to decide on a font for the title, and we put them both up on the corkboard, and we were looking at them, and one of them fell off. And we were like, well, Suzanne has clearly
Suzanne
made
has
her
spoken.
Opinion. And on the very final day when we were wrapping up in the edit room, it was the final day, everybody was, you know, high-fiving and hugging, and oh, this is a beautiful movie, and there were all these butterflies outside the window. And she was known as the Iron Butterfly. We had never seen butterflies before, but on this final day, there they all were. So I think she's still watching over it.
Dana Adam Shapiro's new documentary is called Daughters of the Sexual Revolution, The Untold Story of the Dallas Cowboys Cheerleaders. Former cheerleaders Shannon Baker Worthman and Tony Washington joined us as well today. Thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you for
Thank
having
you,
us.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. And I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.